right, we have one case on our 130 docket today, Lipsky versus Range, in the matter of Stephen and Shyla Lipsky and Alyssa Rich. Counsel have checked in. If you will announce, counsel, who will be arguing today, please. All right. Okay, Mr. Rosenthal, I believe you're beginning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The Texas Citizens Participation Act, also known as the Texas Anti-SLAPP Act, Chapter 27 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, was enacted by the Texas Legislature in 2011 and signed into law by Governor Perry to permit early dismissal of meritless claims that are intended to chill or punish the exercise of the rights of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and freedom to petition that are guaranteed by the constitutions of the United States, the state of Texas, and Texas common law. We submit that the counterclaims against Stephen and Shyla Lipsky, whom I represent, and the third-party claims against Alyssa Rich, who Mr. McCaskill represents, are precisely the type of claims that the legislature had in mind when enacting the Texas Anti-SLAPP Act. In refusing to dismiss these transparently meritless and admittedly retaliatory claims at the outset of the litigation, as required by the new statute, the trial court not only clearly abused its discretion, but, and this is important for purposes of the entitlement to mandamus relief, it failed to protect the Lipskys and Ms. Rich from the very evil that the statute was designed to prevent, which was the need to waste resources, participate in burdensome and harassing discovery, and spend time and energy defending a suit whose purpose is not to ultimately get recovery, but to harass them and chill the right to freedom of expression and freedom of right to petition. Now, in the claims that are the basis of Range's suit against the Lipskys and Ms. Rich, Range asserted defamation, business disparagement, aiding and abetting, and civil conspiracy against the counter defendants, and sought damages in excess of $3 million without the slightest explanation of how that damage award was figured. It's nowhere in the pleadings or in the voluminous evidence that Range produced to the trial court on the eve of the hearing. In our opening brief, the Lipsky's opening brief, we described commentary on slap suits. There's a book authored by a George Pring, a professor at the University of Colorado, and there's a law review article in Texas Wesleyan by Chad Baruch, quoted in the opening brief, which describes the hallmarks of a slap suit, and it's a strategic lawsuit against public participation, and how it works and what the point is. And the description that these commentators provide is precisely what Range alleged in his complaint. That is, they alleged a civil tort based on speaking, expression. It's filed against individuals, and it seeks an absurdly high and totally undocumented amount of damages. And those are all hallmarks of a suit intended to harass as opposed to filed in good faith for the purpose of asserting the cause of action.
And what exactly did Range have to prove, or to what level did they have to prove their case at the trial court?
That's a difficult question. The statute says that they had to prove each essential element of its claim by clear and specific evidence. That's what the statute says, so that's an easy answer. The question of what clear and specific evidence is, or how is it different from clear and convincing or preponderance, is one that I've actually searched for in Texas jurisprudence and haven't found it. So it's a term that doesn't have a definition in the statute or any definition and precedent. But whatever it is, whether it's preponderance or clear and convincing or something in between, Range didn't make an iota of proof in support of its allegations. So that's what Range had to prove. In order to get there, we had to prove by a preponderance of the evidence the claims were that Range asserts are related to expressional interests or rights that are protected by the Constitution and common law. And we feel that the very allegations that Range made, which target statements made by these clients to the Environmental Protection Agency and statements exchanged between the two of them to the public, by definition, those are related to those constitutional rights of freedom of expression that the statute covers. So that's the way it works out. And there was really, at the hearing, no real extended discussion on whether these claims attacked or challenged these freedoms, but rather it was primarily based on, did Range make a case for defamation or business disparagement under Texas law?
Well, it seems to me that there's a problem within the statute, perhaps, because it says they should come forward with prima facie proof, but then again, as you mentioned, it also then says clear and specific evidence.
Well, again, whether the legislature intended a term of art to be created by the use of this language or just intended the words in its ordinary meaning, I think it's clear that the proof has to be specific. I mean, I'm focusing on that. And again, as you might assume, we submit that the proof and the allegations even are not specific. They challenge particular statements that are, at least as far as we could tell on their face, not defamatory, not false, and absolutely privileged. I'll get into in a minute. But the specific proof, for example, of damages is wholly lacking. So that and it's that proof that the even the remotest proof that whatever statements Mr. Lipsky and Ms. Rich, I leave Mrs. Lipsky out because she didn't make any statements, but whatever statements they made caused Range damage, no proof of that whatsoever. Statements that that Range incurred any damage, no proof of that whatsoever. So whatever the test is, our submission is that they flunked it under a reading of the words of the statute.
Do you not think that proof of defamation per se would take away the need to prove specific amount of damages?
The answer to that precise question is yes. If they made some sort of conceivable case of defamation per se, that is a theory that absolves the plaintiff of having to prove exactly how much damages were incurred. But there's nothing that could conceivably constitute defamation per se in this case. Defamation per se, as defined by the Texas courts, and I'll just cite one of them, the Texas Waste Disposal case that's cited in the briefs. I don't have the exact citation at hand, says that defamation per se is akin to, is defamation that is so hurtful to the reputation of the defendant that you can simply assume that there has been damage done. And the examples given are proof of a loathsome disease is one type of defamation per se. Proof that the plaintiff, or not proof, a statement that the plaintiff is engaged in sexual misconduct or has committed a crime, those are defamation per se. But a statement that the speaker thinks that Range contaminated their water can't conceivably be defamation per se under Texas law.
Or what about a statement that Range is corrupt?
I believe the statement was that it's a corrupt system, and that's the kind, and Bentley versus Bunton, the Texas Supreme Court opinion, specifically addressed that and said a claim, a general claim of corruption without an indication that the speaker has some evidence or specific knowledge of exactly what the corruption is are at most what the court said. These are the court's words, amorphous and epithetic. That is, it's basically name-calling. And that does not rise to the level of defamation under Texas law. That's probably the closest defamation per se, but it doesn't come close, at least in our view, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There are other reasons, I guess I alluded to some of the reasons why the statements are transparently not actionable that Range uses for this case. But there are several reasons why that we submit the court shouldn't entertain or should the court below should have seen at the threshold that this case was meritless. First, the statement that the trial court latched on, the only statements that the court mentioned in its order denying the motion to dismiss, were statements to the EPA that were absolutely privileged under precedent of this very court, specifically the Purdue case, which is cited and discussed at length in the brief. A recent case, I believe it's 2009, says that that statements to officials or bodies that have the ability to investigate and take action on alleged violations or conduct are absolutely privileged regardless of truth or falsity and regardless of whether they were uttered with malice. And that principle is a principle of Texas common law. In fact, it was previously stated by this court in an opinion authored by my learned adversary, Chief Justice Casey, in the Five State Helicopters case, a 2004 case in which the court actually spoke at length about the policy reasons behind the absolute privilege and the fact that we have to be able to go to our government officials, those that are charged with redressing misconduct, without fear that we're going to be retaliated against in a civil lawsuit, especially for $3 million worth of damage. So I think that the absolute privilege clearly applies in this case. I said even if the statements were malicious and even if they were false, I think the most obvious thing about this is that the statements that Range has latched onto are not false. Mr. Lipsky never misrepresented that the video that Range is fixated on in this case, the video of flame coming out of his garden hose, he never misrepresented that was coming out of the water source. In fact, the very email that Range admitted into evidence to support its claim that this was a misleading video actually says that the hose was connected to the well vent. And that's the point that Range tries to make. So in this case, we're in a position of saying blue is blue, red is red. There was absolutely no misrepresentation to the EPA about what was depicted in the videotape. And there was not even a hint that anything in the videotape was doctored or changed or falsely represented in any way. I see that my red light is on earlier than I expected, but I will cede the time to my co-counsel. Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Does speech have to be verbal?
At the risk of not knowing where the question is from, I'll answer the question that it does not have to be verbal. I think speech is expressional. If it's intended to express something, I mean, I remember from law school, the burning of a flag could be considered expressional. So it may not be protected expression, but it's expressional. So no, I think there can be nonverbal expression. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rosenthal. Mr. McCaskill.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors, counsel. My name is Sean McCaskill, and along with George Carlton, I represent Alyssa Rich, one of the relators in today's case, and the third-party defendant in the trial court proceeding. In our time this afternoon, I would like to focus on there being no clear and specific evidence of the elements of Range's third-party claims against Alyssa Rich. Range wholly failed to satisfy its burden of establishing by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case for each essential element of its defamation, business disparagement, conspiracy, and aiding and abetting third-party claims against Alyssa Rich. The fact of the matter is, Alyssa Rich merely communicated with the EPA regarding the contamination test results at the Lipsky's property and did not publish any false, defamatory, or disparaging statement regarding Range. As the court is probably aware, Ms. Rich was retained by the Lipsky's to collect test samples from the water well at the Lipsky's property. Those samples were tested by an independent lab, which determined that there was contamination in the water and air at the Lipsky's property. Rich merely communicated those test results to the EPA, and she did not communicate with the media or anybody else except the Lipsky's, the EPA, and the Parker County Fire Department. Rich did not publish any false, defamatory, or disparaging statement regarding Range, as required for defamation or business disparagement under the Texas Supreme Court's cases of WFAA and Prudential, which are cited in our brief at page 11. As to the first part of that, Range claimed that Ms. Rich provided the EPA with false and misleading information. That's simply not the case. Both the Texas Railroad Commission and the EPA undertook their own independent tests, collected samples from that property, and found that there was contamination in the same elements as the samples that Ms. Rich had collected, in fact, in higher concentrations. Thus, Rich's statement to the EPA that there was, in fact, contamination at the Lipsky's property was true and correct, not false and misleading. The second part of the equation is that Rich never made any statement that Range caused the contamination at the Lipsky's property. In the Huckabee case, the Texas Supreme Court's opinion held that the alleged defamatory statement must be specifically directed at the plaintiff who's suing for defamation or business disparagement. But none of the communications that Rich had ever assert or insinuate that Range caused the contamination. Ms. Rich's August 9, 2010 agreement with the Lipsky's to do the testing does not mention Range. Ms. Rich's August 12th email to Mr. Lipsky regarding the proposed testing does not mention Range. And the August 20th email, internal email authored by Willie Lane of the EPA, where he recites the communications from Ms. Rich, does not mention anything about Rich contending that Range caused the contamination. There's no evidence of any statement by Rich asserting that Range caused the contamination.
So we don't know the source then or the reason why the EPA's original order was directed solely to Range Resources?
I think the evidence in the record shows that after Mr. Lipsky initially contacted the EPA, I believe on August 10th, and then Ms. Rich contacted the EPA sometime thereafter, the EPA did its own investigation, looked at the facts. It determined that Range was involved in some activities in that area, and on its own, the EPA determined that there was contamination and that it was probably caused by Range. That was the EPA's investigation on its own, not anything to do with the samples that Ms. Rich collected. Shifting gears to the conspiracy and aiding and abetting claims, Rich's communication of the contamination test results to the EPA does not constitute an unlawful act or assisting in committing a tort, as required to prove conspiracy or aiding and abetting. Range bases these vicarious liability claims of conspiracy and aiding and abetting on an alleged strategy to get the EPA involved by using false and misleading information to manufacture a non-existent imminent danger. Well, as I've discussed previously, that's simply not the case. Rich did not provide the EPA with any false or misleading information, as both the Railroad Commission and the EPA themselves undertook tests and found the same contamination at the Lipsky's property as was demonstrated by the samples that Rich had taken. Secondly, Rich did not manufacture a non-existent imminent danger. The EPA itself, upon doing its own collection of samples and testing, found that the contamination in the Lipsky's water well, quote, posed a variety of risks to the health of persons, end quote. Thirdly, as discussed previously, Rich did not blame Range's operations for the contamination at the property. Rich only said there was contamination, and there was never any assertion and no evidence that Rich identified or even insinuated that Range had caused the contamination at the property. And finally, Your Honors, with respect to the garden hose issue, and Mr. Rosenthal has alluded to this, The information provided to the EPA clearly stated that the gas was coming from the vent, not from the water. Excuse me. The August 20th, 2010 internal EPA email, it's cited in our brief and it's attached as Appendix C, notes that the EPA knew that this water hose was attached to the well vent. It was not the water that was being caught on fire. It was the well vent, the gas coming from that well vent. So neither the EPA nor the public were misled by this video. In conclusion, Your Honor, as I'm running out of time, there is no evidence that Rich made any false, defamatory, or disparaging statements regarding Range or otherwise blamed Range for the contamination at the Lipsky's property. And Rich did not participate in any unlawful act or commit any kind of tort. Thus, Range failed to satisfy its burden of proving by clear and specific elements a prima facie case as to each element of its third-party claims against Alyssa Rich. And based on that, the trial court clearly abused its discretion in denying Ms. Rich's motion to dismiss under the Texas Anti-SLAPP Act. Unless the court has some questions for me, I see my time is about up, and I'll take my seat. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. McCaskill. Mr. Casey.
May it please the court. What you've just heard is a good story, but it does not stack up with the record. It's not supported by the record. The entire premise of the relator's arguments in this proceeding is that Range filed its defamation claims solely for the purpose of silencing and punishing the relator's free speech and petition rights. That's not only flatly contradicted by the record in this case, it absolutely makes no sense. Range was aware that the Lipskys had begun petitioning government authorities and speaking about contamination of their wells as early as December 2009, when they had filed a complaint with the Texas Railroad Commission. In a letter dated September 21, 2010, which is under tab 1 of Range's supplemental brief, the Lipskys expressly informed Range through their attorney that in addition to the Texas Railroad Commission, they had contacted and petitioned the EPA, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, the Parker County Fire Marshal, and the Parker County Appraisal Board regarding the alleged contamination of their well. In that same letter, the Lipskys threatened Range with litigation and local, regional, and national media attention if Range did not resolve the problem. This was in September of 2010, before any test had been conducted whatsoever. Yet, during all of this speech and petitioning activity that took place over an 18-month period of time, and in spite of the harm which the record conclusively shows was caused to Range, its reputation, and its business, and I will cite the court to volume 6 of the clerk's record, page 688, which is the affidavit of Range's general counsel, David Poole, in which he specifically sets out that there's been direct and pecuniary economic losses, lost profits, and loss of reputation and goodwill in a sum of $3 million as a result of their false and defamatory conduct. But in spite of the fact that they were petitioning the EPA and all of these other governmental agencies during this 18-month period, despite the fact that shortly after they made the threat that there would be national, regional, and local media attention that would be brought down on Range, and that they did follow through on that threat shortly afterwards. Despite that, and despite the fact that Range was eventually exonerated of all wrongful conduct, Range did nothing to chill, intimidate, censor, punish, or silence the relators for exercising any of their free speech or petition rights, which is the type of activity that, as the court knows, the anti-SLAPP statute was designed to prevent. If the record shows anything, it shows that every time Range was hit with a notice of a complaint, was made aware of some publication in which they were falsely accused of contaminating the well, was made aware of some petitioning activity, the blaming it for wrongful conduct falsely, Range turned the other cheek. My point is this, Your Honors, that if Range was seeking to silence or punish the relators for exercising their free speech and petition rights, they would have logically filed their defamation claims long before they did. The mere fact that they filed their claims in July 2011, long after the damage that Range complains of was done, long after Range had been fully exonerated by the Railroad Commission, the fact that they waited until after the lawsuit was filed to allege these claims, I believe, proves conclusively that this is not a slap suit. The statute does not apply to this case. It was never intended to apply to a case like this. What possible harm has Range caused to the relators by filing their countersuit? What possible advantage has Range gained by filing its countersuit after all of this time passed and after all of the activity that they claim that they were chilled and punished for participating in has occurred? The answer is none. The fact is there's nothing about this case, absolutely nothing about this case that even remotely resembles a typical slap suit where a party files a frivolous lawsuit for the sole purpose of punishing, censoring, silencing, intimidating a citizen who's publicly speaking out about a matter of public interest and so forth. What I think we have here, Your Honors, is a situation that commentators that we've cited in our brief, I believe Mr. Rosenthal referred to one, and courts in other states have expressed concern about for years. And that is defendants abusing the anti-SLAPP procedures to prematurely test the legitimate claims of a plaintiff as a tactic to delay and drive up the cost and increase the burdens on plaintiffs for strategic purposes, leverage a settlement, or what have you.
Isn't that the new way law's practiced?
Excuse me?
Isn't that the new way law's practiced? Isn't that what the legislature seems to prefer?
Well, Your Honor, there is that type of activity that takes place, and it's abhorrent. If the court were to say the SLAPP statute applies in this case, I think the court would be condoning the very type of activity that I know this court and other courts of this state abhor.
So we have to balance First Amendment rights against the right to seek redress in the courts, and our legislature has pretty well announced they don't want citizens seeking redress in the courts.
I hope that's not what the legislature intended when they drafted this statute, because that would be, of course, unconstitutional, and perhaps one day, if that is the way this statute is interpreted, one day a court will declare this statute unconstitutional, because the right that Range had to sue the Lipskys and Ms. Rich for their defamatory acts and business disparagement is a parallel and equally fundamental right to their rights to petition and free speech, as I know Your Honor knows that. And I think that that's why the legislature was very careful when it drafted the statute to create a burden of proof that was low enough so that legitimate claims pre-discovery, even with minimal merit, could proceed. And I believe that's what reason the legislature drafted or enacted Section 2705C, establishing this prima facie burden of proof. Now, the relators have paid lip service to that burden in their briefs, but what they've actually are arguing and they're inviting the court to do is to flip the burden and apply a preponderance of the evidence burden to the Range. Well, that's the burden that the relators have, not Range. Range's burden is simply in order to overcome a motion to dismiss was simply to present clear and specific prima facie proof of its claims, which case law has defined prima facie proof as only that minimum quantum of proof required to support a rational inference that the allegation is true. You might analogize that to a legal sufficiency standard, where you disregard any other evidence or any other inference in the record that might be contrary to the allegation, and you only rely on that evidence and those inferences that support the allegation. That's the proper standard that should be applied here. Whatever other evidence or inference there may be in this record that might arguably show that some of these individual statements that the relators made were true, that's to be disregarded. We don't believe that there is evidence in this record showing that the statements that they made, that Range contaminated their water well, that because of Range's contamination, that they could light their water on fire, and that Range is corrupt and owns the judges and the system. We don't believe there's any evidence whatsoever in this record that would show that any of that is true or even substantially true or minimally true. I've thought about this a lot. If Range hasn't met its burden in this case, on this record, you wonder what counterclaim plaintiff could overcome a motion to dismiss. It would be difficult for me to imagine a case where it could. I don't believe that's what the legislature intended when they created this standard. Justice Gardner or Chief Justice Livingston, one of you asked a question about clear and specific. I've wrestled with that, and this may sound silly, this morning I thought, okay, if I say my dog has fleas, that's clear, that's specific, that's direct. If I say someone told me that my dog has a condition that causes it to itch and scratch itself a lot, that's hearsay. It's not specific. You're not sure what the problem is there. Maybe that's what the legislature meant when they used the term clear and specific, that it just simply be direct evidence. You could look at, that makes sense. A reasonable person will look at it and say it makes sense. I don't know.
And who has the burden to come forward showing that a privilege doesn't apply at this stage of the game?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it's our burden. And I assume you're talking about the absolute privilege.
Right.
I believe it was our burden and that we met that burden. I will say this, I don't think the court needs to reach the question of absolute privilege at all. By the way, your handout under tab, I believe, A, list the three primary communications and statements that Range claims are defamatory, and all of the individual statements, which in the context in which they were made, and when you look at them in their entirety, would lead a reasonable person to perceive that those statements, those three statements, are fact. But the court does not, and probably, I hesitate to say this, should not reach absolute privilege because there's a mountain of evidence in this case of statements that were not made in the course of a quasi-judicial or judicial proceeding. And even those that may have been, there's evidence that those statements or the gist of those statements were made and repeated to others, including the media. One example of this is under tab B of your handout, and I don't by any means by including that in your handout mean to suggest that that's the best evidence we have of defamatory remarks, but it's one that shows it's an Associated Press article in which Stephen Lipsky blames fracking by Range for the contamination in his water well. says he can light his water on fire, and suggests that the Range and the system in which it operates is corrupt. There's evidence in the record of similar statements being made in other news articles. There's videotapes of news programs, local news programs, Channel 11, Channel 8, I believe, in which they show the video that the Lipsky's made with fire coming out of the water hose. And there was no doubt, at least in the TV news reporter's mind, and as the record shows, others who viewed that video, they believed that was water coming out of that hose, and that hose was connected to a water line and not a gas vent. I would just encourage the court to look at those video excerpts.
Can I ask a question about that? We've seen that video, or one video in particular, and I'm wondering if there's evidence in the record showing how those videos were transmitted to or released or communicated to the media so that they were shown on the news.
Your Honor, let me back up a little bit further. There's evidence that Alyssa Rich provided the videos to the EPA. I can't point you specifically to a place in the record, but I believe if you look, you'll see that there's a clear inference, and in fact, I believe that one of the news reporters, forget his name, Channel 8, mentioned that he received that from the homeowner, who did not want to be identified. He wanted to remain anonymous under advice of counsel. Your Honors, this is not a case. I see my time's up. I'll just ask the court to deny the petitions for mandamus. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I believe Mr. Rosenthal is going to handle the rebuttal. Is that correct?
I'd first like to respond to a contention that was made early in Mr. Casey's argument about damages and what he called conclusive proof of damage that was sustained as a result of these acts of defamation and disparagement. I think that term is entirely inappropriate. I think the term is conclusory, because what he said, what he alluded to, was an affidavit of one of Range's corporate officials that said, we have suffered damages, we have lost profits, and we have sustained direct economic loss. That is a conclusory, absolutely meaningless piece of evidence to support a claim of damage. It certainly isn't clear and specific within the meaning, or within, as however that term is defined, whether there's, again, some sort of legal term of art associated with it, or a standard English definition. That is not specific evidence of damages. And it's because it is implausible and, in fact, preposterous to believe that Range Resources, a national drilling company at the center of this nationwide ongoing dispute about the environmental effects of fracking, suffered specific pecuniary loss as a result of of any statements uttered by these individuals. It's implausible on its face. But it certainly isn't supported by any of the evidence that Range submitted and that Mr. Casey mentioned. In describing the relative burdens or how the statute works, the way that it was artfully described actually seemed to have it reversed, and that there is some sort of higher burden on us and there is a minimal burden on Range to support the elements of its claim. That's absolutely not true under a plain reading of the statute. They are required to show a prima facie case, meaning they have to show evidence, but the evidence has to be clear and specific. I don't think that resembles the legal sufficiency test that Mr. Casey would have this court apply in saying whether Range's claims have merit. Mr. Casey also flipped the scenario here, making Range the victim of abusive and harassing litigation by the Lipskys and Ms. Rich seeking dismissal of this case. And at the risk of invoking an overused metaphor, that's Alice in Wonderland. Range is here alleging what amounts to a personal tort, defamation. We've been insulted. We've been impugned. Our reputation in the community has been degraded by these activities. And the idea that these individuals could be guilty of that by communicating with the government, by and if you read the exact quotes, the exact language, raising the concern that their water has been contaminated by Range's activities or by fracking activities, it's just not possible to infer any sort of defamation or disparagement, and this case is just not actionable. It's exactly the opposite. Finally, if I may, Mr. Casey referred to this sinister letter authored by the Lipskys' counsel to Range, threatening widespread exposure and public embarrassment if they didn't get their way. That is indeed attached as Exhibit 1 or Attachment 1 to Range's supplemental brief. I do want to point out this is a letter from counsel to Range, not anything that was made public, not to the general population, but I urge the court to read it. At the end of the letter, here's the sinister, nefarious language invoked by the Lipskys' lawyer. It is the Lipskys' hope that this situation may be resolved without the need for litigation, especially considering the amount of local, regional, and national media attention a case of this type may produce. To that end, the Lipskys are hopeful that the site visit and future discussions may result in a quick resolution of these issues. That is not a threat of exposure and a threat to commit defamation. That is a reasonable, responsible approach to an honest dispute that Range turned into a defamation and disparagement suit. The mandamus petition should be granted. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rosenthal, Mr. McCaskill, Mr. Casey. We appreciate your arguments today and all of your briefing and work on this matter. Your case is now submitted. We have no further cases, so we will ask the court to adjourn us now.